Wild Precious Life is brought to you in part by Visible Voice Books in Tremont, Ohio. With a glass of wine or cup of joe in hand, readers can explore a curated selection of new and secondhand books. Learn more and shop for your next favorite read at visiblevoicebooks.com. And we are brought to you by Book Soup, known for floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, high-profile author readings, limited edition books, vinyl records, and celebrity clientele. Book Soup is an essential stop on any tour of Los Angeles. Find your next great read and shop online at booksoup.com. I was talking to a friend the other day about love stories, and we were reminiscing about the kinds of films we loved in our 20s. There was Before Sunrise, where this guy and girl met in a train and spent one day falling madly in love in Vienna. And Four Weddings and a Funeral, with all those couples and speeches and drama and dresses. And then there was this one movie, The English Patient, where a man and a woman fell passionately in love in the desert. I have always been a sucker for a Hollywood romance. But they don't always tell the rest of the story, do they? What happens after the happily ever after? What happens when the steamy, far-flung romance is replaced by the day-in, day-out reality of unloading the dishwasher or stressing about your job? Is it even possible to hold on to the magic? Our guest today would argue yes. Jonathan Penner is an actor and screenwriter known for producing and starring in the film The Last Supper, as well as acting in the television series Rude Awakening. Jonathan is also known for multiple appearances on the reality series Survivor. But we speak to him today about arguably his most famous role, that of husband and caregiver to his wife, Stacey Tytle, an Academy Award-nominated director, screenwriter, and producer who passed away earlier this year. Says Jonathan about his wife, quote, "She made all of my dreams come true." So today on Wild Precious Life, we have for you a real Hollywood love story with both before and after the happily ever after. Jonathan Penner, welcome to Wild Precious Life.
Thank you. What a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to talking to you and hearing all that you have to say about living a wild and precious life.
Well, we often start out by asking our guests about their heart story, but for you, I want to phrase that slightly differently. Will you tell us your love story?
I was married for 29 years and with my wife for 31 years, almost from the day we met. We were inseparable, and my wife was an extraordinary person and the kindest, gentlest, most passionate person that I have met, unfortunately, had a genetic gene mutation, and that gave her ALS, caused her to develop the symptoms of ALS, and she died of ALS after a battle of about 3.5 years. She passed away in January of this year. It's now October. I was very fortunate to meet Stacey when I met her. I really am a believer that, you know, there's not just sort of one person that you could love. You know, it may be the love of your life, but that's because I was ready to have the love of my life walk into my life, as was she. And we walked into each other's lives, you know, and we had similar backgrounds. We'd actually been to the same summer camp one summer together without knowing each other.
No way.
You know, and we were both fascinated by the movies, which we did together, made movies together, television together, had children together, were interested in raising our kids in the same ways, really. So, you know, we walked into each other's lives and were kind of thunderstruck by each other. And as I say, we were basically inseparable from the time that we met until the day that she died.
Can you tell us, do you remember when you met?
Oh, it's a great story, actually. I mean, or I guess you'll be the judge of that. But In a nutshell, I'm an actor, have worked as an actor, and was working as an actor at the time on a movie with another actor named Jason Alexander. This was just before Seinfeld. And he and I were in this movie together out of town. We were in St. Louis. Anyway, Jason was happily married to a wonderful, wonderful woman and had a booming career. He just won a Tony Award. Anyway, I said to him, like, I want what you have, you know. How do I get all of that great stuff? And he said, I don't know. Anyway, so he was going to introduce me. I'll tell the whole story. He had just been on Broadway in this show that he won a Tony for called Jerome Robbins Broadway. And the show is him and like 40 women. He was the only guy in the whole show. And he'd left, this is true, he'd left the show, he'd been replaced in the show and he'd gone on to, I think he probably shot the pilot for Seinfeld at that point. Anyway, he said, look, I'll take you, we'll go to have some dinner and then I'll take you to the bar where all the girls, the women from the show go after the show. We'll walk in together and if you can't get lucky, you know, there that night, then you got no game at all, you know. I said, great, let's go. A couple of nights before that, he calls. He says, you know, we're going to listen, maybe my wife wants to meet you. Can she have dinner with us? I said, yeah, great, of course, you know. So, and then he says, you know, the next day, he says, yeah, I'm not comfortable leaving my wife at the restaurant when we go to the bar. Can her cousin join us? And then they'll go to the movie, so they'll do what they're going to do, and then you and I will go to the bar. I said, great, you know, wonderful. So that night we met at a restaurant and I walked in and this gorgeous girl walks in right in front of me. And I would never forget it because I noticed her right away. And she walks up to the host stand or whatever, you know, and she says, oh, Jason Alexander party, or I'm here to meet, you know, the four of us having dinner. And I said, oh, we're having dinner together, you know. So we had a great meal and at about 10:30 or, you know, 10 o'clock, Jason said, okay, well, you know, I'm pointing at my watch. I realize you guys can't see. I'm pointing at my, you know, I'm acting like Jason pointing at my watch. If we're going to go, we should go, you know. And I said, I ain't going anywhere. What are you talking about? What do I, you know, why the hell do I want to go? Why would we go to a bar to meet women when I've just met this fantastic woman? Let's go do something else. So we went bowling. Which used to be a thing, you know, it shows how old I am. It's like, you know, what do you want to do? Let's go bowling. Anyway, we went bowling and had a ball. And then he and his wife are like an old married couple at this point. They've been married. They don't want to hang out with, you know, us. So I lived, I don't know if you know New York, but where are you? Are you in New York?
I'm in Cleveland, which some people call the New York of Ohio, but not very many people.
That's absurd. That's a silly thing.
But I've been to New York
many
times.
They also call it the mistake on the lake. They call it a lot of things, I know.
We also call it the Believeland. Yes.
I like Cleveland. I spent a lot of time in Cleveland. I shot a movie in Cleveland. Anyway, so after bowling, when Jason and Dana, his wife, said like, okay, we're going home. I said, hey, you live downtown. She lived on East 34th Street. And I lived on West 10th Street. So, yeah, we live downtown, but that's like, you know, that's like
it's
Cleveland and Detroit. You live in the Midwest. I'll see you home, you know. So we got into a cab together. I said, let's share a cab. And I said, let's have one more drink, you know. We'll have one more drink. I'll take you to my local bar. So I took her to a bar in the West Village, and we had another drink, and we kissed for the first time that night. And then we were walking home, you know, and I walked her past my apartment. And she said, okay, well, you know, what a fantastic night. And I said, come on, this, you know, we can't end this night. Come upstairs. And she's like, I'm not going upstairs with you. What are you, nuts? You know, I mean, to her great credit, right? She's like, I ain't going anywhere with you. And I said, nothing will happen. You have my word of honor. I'll give you pajamas and we'll go to sleep. I just don't want the night to end. And that was the truth. And we went up. She said, okay. And she went upstairs and I gave her sweatpants and a t-shirt and we climbed into bed and we just held each other and kissed and we were inseparable ever since then.
That is beautiful. Were Jason Alexander and his wife in on this setup? Did he lure you there with the promise of 40 women and then bait and switch?
Well, it was a very soft setup. right? Because if it didn't work out at dinner, then we had a plan, you know? So it worked out perfectly.
I love that she needed to trust you in order to stay, and that you gave her your word that nothing would happen and that you made her feel safe. I know many, 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 many women for whom what you just described, the idea of wanting to be together, but wanting to take it slowly as adults, almost never happens. But that's what people wish for, is to just be together.
Yeah, they want to be together. You know, you have to be able to trust, and you have to, I mean, not that what I did was so fantastic. All I did was treat her like a person, and I respected her, and, you know, I assuaged her fear. She wanted to be with me. I wanted to be with her, and she was afraid of something, and I said, you don't have to be afraid of that. That's not going to happen. I will keep you safe. And I said that to her. That was the basis of our relationship. Not that I would keep her safe, but that we would keep each other safe, that we would respect each other and love each other. And, you know, there was no, I mean, we had a faithful, you know, we never slept with anybody else. We never did anything. You know, we were each other's best friends and each other's great loves.
Listening to you talk about your wife, I'm half in love with her already, too.
Oh, thank you, God, what a person.
Thank you for sharing. I think sometimes when someone you love passes away, one of the hardest things is that people say, I'm so sorry. Oh, that I'm so sorry for your loss. But they don't ask you to talk about them, as though talking about them is painful. I find talking about them is what you want to do. You want to tell the stories, right? Because you want to know that they're still alive. You describing that there are men out there who will hold a woman in their arms and trust that they'll be safe for as long as they're able is like the most romantic thing I think I've ever heard on this show.
So. Well, I don't mean to laugh. I'm very happy. I'm happy. We had a very romantic relationship. You know, we were both romantic people. We were very, very, we loved each other very, very passionately. And, but a lot of that came from, that trust and that vulnerability, you know.
I know that Stacy directed you earlier in your career and not so early, right? More recently. Was that vulnerability present in your working relationship?
Well, to be directed by her, sure. I mean, you know, an actor has to give him or herself, themselves over to the director if they trust the director. You know, I know, listen, there are a lot of asshole actors who would say, I'm not an asshole. I'm taking care of, you know, I'm the only one who's responsible for my career, for my instrument, for my work. You know, there are a lot of big star actors that I know, have worked with, and have worked with people that I know who were like, don't talk to me. You hired me to be me, to do this thing that I do, and I don't need to hear from you. I don't care what you think my motivation is, right? You know, so just stay out of my way and just yell action and yell cut, and it's going to be fine. And maybe that's true. I don't know. But I never had that relationship with the director myself, and with Stacy, whatever she wanted me to do, I would try to, you know, give to her. But honestly, casting, directing is like 90% casting. You can't, it is true. You cast the right person and let them do their thing. You didn't cast anybody else because that's the person for the part. And you're going to let them do what they're going to do. You know, you direct them a little bit. You say a little more to the left. Or you say, have you thought about this? Did the vulnerability extend to our relationship? Of course.
The two of you guys worked in Hollywood for a long time together. My understanding of Stacy's story from what I've read and from what I've heard in other interviews is that she received this Oscar nomination for a short that, had she been a man, probably would have led to bigger things sooner. But as a female director, during the time that she was a female director, she had to work harder than men in a similar role. Is that a fair characterization?
I think so. I mean, of course it is. There's no question. Stacy was extraordinarily talented, tenacious, ambitious, lovable person, you know, and came up in a class. When I say class, I'm talking about a group of directors who, the men, not all of them. I mean, this is the sticking point. Not every one of them became Quentin Tarantino or David O. Russell or Steven Soderbergh or the guy. guys that she sort of came up with. I mean, she literally heard things like, "You're great, but we already had a movie directed by a woman this year." You know? Or, "You're going to hate to hear this, but I'm just more comfortable talking to your husband." Or, I mean, you know, terrible things that she heard. Stacey, by late in her career, she was already in her late 40s or 50s, was trying to get, like, diversity program slots at NBC because then she couldn't get arrested in television. You know, "I'm a diversity hire. Hire a woman. Hire somebody over the age of 45 so that I can, like, direct an episode of Grey's Anatomy," or whatever it is, you know. I mean, this is literally an Oscar-nominated Mensa. This woman was a genius. And I don't use that term lightly. She was literally a genius, right? And she's talking to some younger woman who wanted her as a mentor, you know, who said, "Well, should I apply to this NBC program?" And Stacey's like, "You should. I'm applying to it." And the woman was literally like, "Stacey Title is applying to this program?" She was heartbroken. Not because it was just like, if you have to apply to this, who is a person that she looked up to, you know, Stacey had directed 4 feature films, had an Oscar nomination, you know, had a career in Hollywood, as painful as it was. And the woman's like, "If you have to deal with this, what the hell am I going to have to deal with?" There is an unconscious bias. And even Stacey would admit to suffering from an unconscious bias. When she thought about what does a director look like, she didn't think, "Oh, it's a gorgeous woman." That's not who she thought of, you know, even though she was a director, right? She thought of some white guy strutting around in jodhpurs with a megaphone, you know, some hard-ass guy.
Sarah, our lead producer on this show, was fortunate to be mentored by Stacey. She describes the way your wife believed in people's talent with complete and utmost faith, that she saw strength and talent and versatility and wonder in people that they didn't always see in themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, no, she was an extraordinary person who, you know, she had been a journalist and made herself into a filmmaker, right? You know, which is not the normal course of events. So if people said, "Oh, I'm interested in this," she'd be like, "Okay, I'll get you a job doing that. Let's help you do that. How do I help you?" She understood intrinsically. It was never something we discussed, but, you know, people are like, you know, the bad analogy is plants. You give them water and sunshine and they grow. That's what she was like. She was like water and sunshine all the time, you know, and it was extraordinary to witness and to be part of, you know. She did that for me. She made all my dreams come true. Everything that I have that's good, I thank her for. It's the truth. And she gave me this is going to sound backwards, but it's true. You have the opportunity to care for somebody. And I mean that literally, to literally take care of somebody, to give care and to help somebody through what turned out to be a terminal situation, but it doesn't always have to, you know, she really suffered, but to take responsibility for her care and to take care of her and to give her dignity, to honor her presence and her passing, was an extraordinary gift that I got. She didn't give it to me, but I got it because I was with her while she was going through her illness, you know, and that was an extraordinary.
If you don't mind, let's talk about that a little bit. I don't know what it's like to lose a partner, but I do know something about being a caregiver. My dad died of brain cancer last year. And before that, we rotated through as caregivers, moved in there part-time, rotated him in his bed, gave him sponge baths, sang to him when he could no longer talk. We held his hand when he lost the ability to see. I imagine that you experienced a version of this. What was it like to be both a husband and a caregiver?
Well, it was terrible. I mean, it was horrible, you know. But as a caregiver, something I had never done and had to learn, you know, in some ways that was very, very enriching because it was a new learning experience for me. It was a new way of giving her love and attention and affection and to treat her with great care and to show her how she was loved, that she was loved, that she was adored, in fact. I grew through it in ways that I wish I, you know, you wish you're still an idiot. Wisdom is very expensive, you know, and you know, wise people have had experiences and they're not all great, right? That's how you learn, is you're challenged. I mean, that's the, I don't want to talk about survivor, we can talk about survivor, but you know, when they talk about challenges in life, the reason they use that word in survivor is that you are challenged. And how do you rise to the challenge? How do you cope with the challenge? That's how you face yourself, you know. You face yourself and your ability. Oh, shit, I didn't win. I couldn't do it. Or I did. It's a small victory. You know, these challenges. And that's how you grow stronger and stronger and more experienced. And you move forward. And if you don't have any challenges, you know, if you never run into a wall that you got to figure out how to get over, through, around, under, you know, then it means you're sitting in your room and you never went outside. You know, you never tried to open the door. You know, and so... you're not going to learn anything sitting in your room. That's all. So it was terrible, and it was very enriching too.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly. And our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.
I found that being a caregiver was simultaneously heartbreaking, and then there would be these moments of crazy love or joy. And they seem a little bit like gallows humor, but I'll give you an example. So my father had brain cancer. So one of the things that happened is he lost his memory. He had always had a crackerjack memory. He could tell you sports games scores from 30 years ago, and he lost all that. So I could show him, I realized one night I could show him every NCAA ball game, every basketball game that was great from the past 30 years. And we watched one amazing game after another. Buzzer beaters, games where the team came back by 22, Cinderella. Every single game we watched was brand new to him. He got to have them all over again. And again, it was heartbreaking because he's losing his memory. He's forgetting who we are. But we also had these moments of tenderness amid all of that. And I'm wondering if you can tell us anything about living in grief. How do you go on?
So I would encourage people to not be afraid of their own emotions. And if they cannot get out of a debilitating or painful state, to seek either counsel, religious counsel, talk to a trusted confidant, and they will help you. I say to people all the time, people very, very close to me who are going through a lot of pain. You have to understand, my family has also lost their mother, they've lost their sister, they've lost their daughter, you know, their dear friends, cousin. You know, it's senseless. This was, as we've said, a very, very beautiful person, you know. And I say to them, I say, I don't know. I have no idea what, I don't have the tools to help, but I have the resources. I have enough brain power to be able to help you find some resources. You know, I can listen and tell you that I'm here for you. I love you. And I feel for you. And I'm really with you as you're going through this. So I don't know if that's helpful. I don't know if that's advice or what that is. But that's where my head went to.
I think a lot of what you said rings incredibly true for me. One, giving yourself permission to feel, right? This tremendous love that you had for this person doesn't go away because the person is no longer with you. That love is still right here. So giving yourself permission to feel. And we just spoke with Lori Gottlieb on this show. She wrote, maybe you should talk to someone this book that's being turned into a series. And the idea is simply that, yeah, sometimes you do need to sit with someone in your grief, someone who knows how to sit with you and hold you in those moments, and being not afraid to feel and also not afraid to go to someone who can help you heal. The late writer Rachel Held Evans, people who listen to the show will have heard me say it before, that we live inside an unfinished story, and that you live inside your unfinished story, but you also live inside Stacy's unfinished story. And there are wishes and blessings that she surely had for you that you carry with you now, that all of us who've lost people are living inside of the unfinished stories of those who are no longer walking with us. And out of an honor and love for them, we keep putting one foot in front of the other.
The way that any of us can honor anybody is to live in a way that they would like to live. They cannot do it. We have an opportunity right now to, as people alive on Earth, to do stuff that we may take for granted, or we may think, oh, that's not that big a deal. But boy, they would give they'd give anything to be back and able to just do it, to just do the effing dishes, you know, to just make their bed, to just give you a hug, to tell your kids how much you love them. They'd give anything. Stacy could do that. And so we have to do that, because that's really what life is about. Yes, of course, she would have wanted to have directed another movie to win the Academy Award. She didn't win. What she really would want to do is give me a big hug and give me a big kiss and tell me how much she loves me, how proud she is of me, how much she loved spending time with me. I really believe that, you know, and that's what we can do. That's what we can do right now. That's why I'm doing this podcast. I have dedicated myself now to making as many connections, to being as kind as I can be, to living the way that Stacy would want to live if she could, and the way that I have seen that I can live. You know, it's as simple as that. Nothing I'd rather do.
You heard it here then, guys. Love and live magnanimously, if not because you want to, because the people who loved you magnanimously would have wanted you to, and to celebrate those everyday moments that the people who are no longer with us don't have. In some ways, I am angry at your survivor label that you carry as the ultimate survivor guy, because there's this terrible irony about that label now, right? Stacy is gone, and yet you survive.
Survivor was a nice part of my life, is a nice part of my life. It was like 100 days of my life. I'm old. I'm going to be 60 on my next birthday. You know what I mean? I had a lot of days. So yeah, survivor, you know, is a big part of my identity in the world. My mother is a Holocaust survivor, right? She was part of this crazy true story of the 50 children. And it's a great story. She was one of the 50 children. She was 5 years old when she came to this country on a boat with 49 other kids. Anyway, they had like a reunion. There's still a couple of those kids who are now all in their 80s or 90s. She's the youngest at 88. Are still around, and their family and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. We did a Zoom call, a little reunion. And then after that, I had a Zoom call with some kids from Syracuse who have an online survivor game. They asked me would I help them or encourage them or, you know, talk to them about survivor. I said, of course I would. I would be happy to. And I was. So I was talking to another friend. I said, oh, I got this survivor thing. And then I got this survivor thing. And they're like, what do you, you know, ah, this Holocaust survivor and this, act, you know, the survivor TV show. And now I'm the survivor of ALS. And, you know, so yeah, I'm the survivor guy.
Tell me your mom's story. How did she end up a child? How did she end up one of the 50 children on that boat?
There was an extraordinary couple in Philadelphia in the late 30s, the Krause family, who knew that things were not going well for the Jewish people in Europe, and said, you know, let's see if we can get some of these kids in. So the Krause family was were part of a Jewish club organization, you know, golf club or social club. There were some dead visas that had been assigned that had never been collected, that had worked their way through the system, but were just sitting there. Right. So Krause said, he knew somebody at the State Department. He said, if I can I get those, if I can get affidavits from my club that we will adopt all these kids that don't, their parents don't get out. And they said, that we can do. My mother and her sister, ages 5 and 8, were part of this kinder, what was called the kinder transport, and were taken away from their parents for a number of months, put on a boat, taken to America. There's lots of intrigue and espionage of getting these visas approved by the Nazis, and crazy, fantastic story. I mean, it would make a great movie, honestly. And some of the kids, most of the kids' parents did get out, including my mother and her sister's parents made it out. But some of the kids didn't and were adopted and were raised in Philadelphia. But, you know, this was a real mitzvah. And about 1,000 people, we figured out, from these 50 kids, their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren were allowed to, you know, live. I mean, I would not have survived if it hadn't been for this. I never would have been born. My mother would have died in Auschwitz with her grandparents and her aunt, who all perished, you know. So, you know, it's a fabulous story. There's a good book about it, and there's a little movie.
That's an incredible story. I've never heard this story before. I'm picturing what it must have been like for those parents to put their children on that boat. I am having goosebumps. I'm a mother of 3 myself, but to know in your gut that you have to do this thing to keep your child safe, but to not know whether you're ever going to see your child again, that they had that love and faith and maybe even something deeper, just this survivor instinct that they had to do that. My God. Did your mother talk about this? I know from other conversations that there tended to be, and there are all kinds of people, but there tended to be 2 approaches to if you went through that. For some families, they never spoke of it. I don't want to bring that horrible tragedy to my children. So some people never spoke of it, but of course it was always alive in them. And then for other people, it was just part of their story that was handed down to their children. Which family were you?
My mother was very much would talk about it. I knew the story from the time I knew any story, because she's like, you're a miracle. I'm a miracle. Every day on this earth for me is a effing gift. Most of the people died. There's no reason why I'm still here. It was absolute dumb effing luck that my mother saw that thing. My father was out of town. He never would have permitted it to happen. He came back and found out that I was getting put on a boat, and he went bananas. You know, all this stuff. So she made sure I knew about it. Whereas her sister, who had 1 daughter, never talked about it, hated to talk about it. It was absolutely, you know, it was so painful for her. And it was interesting, this Zoom reunion, to hear the different versions that some of these kids, you're right, hadn't heard about it till they were 30 or 40 years old, you know, didn't even know that they're, you know, how'd you get here? Oh, I came on a boat and, you know, they didn't want to talk about it at all, whereas others are like, you better go raise money for this organization. You better keep this story alive. You better remember 6 million of us died and the fact that we're here so we can keep that story alive. It's the only reason that we survived. You know, very, very interesting opposite spectrum of reactions.
I wonder if that storytelling, I've heard it said that actors are in part just storytellers, and I wonder if this storytelling that came through your family, this story of survival, this story of you being a miracle, I wonder if that in any way fed into you becoming an actor.
Maybe. I mean, my brother isn't an actor. It's a very clean way to look at things, but it's probably too clean.
Well, when did you know that you wanted to be an actor?
Oh, as a kid. No, very, very young. No, I was 8 years old. You know?
How did you go from wanting to act to actually being an actor?
You know, it was very different 40 years ago, 35 years ago when I started acting, right? I came out of college. I had a little bit of acting education, not much of one, but some, you know, I had some idea. I liked to be on stage. And you read the showbiz papers. There used to be papers that you could buy every week that had auditions in there, you know, And you start to audition around until you get a professional gig, and then you get an agent, and then you get a movie. You know, it took me 3 or 4 years before I, as you know, basically waiting tables and doing shows with, you know, U-Hauls that you drive around with the scenery in the back and stuff like that before I, and then things started, you know, things start to come together sort of quickly, right? Things start to snowball. I got a lot of commercial work. I was a very successful commercial actor for a number of years. I did some soap work. I did some independent film work. And then I got like White Palace, which was this movie with Jason. You know, that was a studio movie. And then I met my wife, and then we made a short, and then I did a TV series, and then I used the money, you know, like that. Things. But I took, you know, it was not an overnight thing. It took years of pounding the pavement, as we used to say, pounding the pavement.
Do you remember an early role that you got that was actually probably a kind of a terrible role, but felt awesome to you because it was a new role, and even if it was a U-Haul that you're driving around with scenery, do you remember an early role like that?
Oh, they were all great. I loved every role that I did. I was the sure guy. Put up your hand if you're sure, if you're confident, you're not going to smell. I was that guy. I was a Levi's 501 jeans guy. I did a terrible movie, and I'm not good in the movie, but Sandy Bullock was my love interest in the movie. Sandy Bullock, yep. And it's not a good movie. But I did the best. I had a director who had no idea how to direct me. I'd never been in a movie. I had no idea what I was doing. And I think that's very obvious from the movie. Sandy, on the other hand, comes out smelling like a rose because she was fantastic. She was wonderful. I did a soap. I played a scumbag on a soap. That was hilarious and great fun. Every role I ever got, I was so happy to get, you know.
Yeah. I'm a writer, and I can still remember the feeling of some of my first paid gigs. So you mentioned being the sure roll-on deodorant guy. One of my first paid writing gigs was to write ad copy and proofread it for boxes of deodorant. And the idea that anyone's going to pay me to write, right? I wrote a trifold for a veterinarian talking about the difference between a CAT scan and an MRI and an X-ray for your pet. And I got paid to write. And these were paid writing gigs. And I was delighted by them. Even though, looking back, I didn't know anything about any of that. Just excited to be working within your craft. Jonathan Penner, I could talk to you all day, but we have a wrap-up that we do here, and I want to honor your time. So I'm going to lead us into our closing questions that we do with folks. These are, there's not a point system. They're just easy.
I'm not going to win? Okay, damn it. All right, I'll do
there's
it anyway.
No prize. You just pick one. Okay, for you, but multiple choice, dogs or cats?
I have both. I'm not going to pick. I love all both. Right. I have a cat named Blue and a dog named Tootsie.
Ooh, for the movie?
Yes, because she looks like Dustin Hoffman in Dread. She's a long black dog. People think it's because she looks like a Tootsie Roll, but it's because she looks like Dustin Hoffman in Dread. She's a long-haired dachshund.
I love it. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Mountains or beach?
I guess the beach. I love to swim. But I like the mountains too, but if I had to pick one, I'd go to the beach.
All right. Are you an early bird or a night owl?
I've become much more of an early bird. I used to be a night owl, but now I'm up at 6:30 every day.
All right. When it comes to reality TV shows, would you say that you're more of a Great British Bake Off fan, or are you more into a show like Alone?
I like the Great British Bake Off. I don't watch a hell of a lot of TV. That's the truth. I don't watch a lot of TV. I do watch Survivor, and I used to watch the Great British Bake Off. Stacey and I love that.
Excellent.
She watched a lot of that.
Are you a risk taker, or are you the person who always knows where the Band-Aids are?
Both.
And what's a favorite movie that you love?
My favorite movie is a movie that few people know anymore. It's called The American Friend. It's a 1979 German film directed by a German man named Wim Wenders, spelled W-I-M-W-E-N-D-E-R-S. It's about the Ripley character that Matt Damon played in The Talented Mr. Ripley.
That's a great movie.
It's based on another book about Ripley. And he's played by an actor named Dennis Hopper, who you know if you saw. And there's a wonderful actor named Bruno Ganz, German, who plays a character named Jonathan in the movie. And it's, some people think it's very slow, some people think it's very strange. They're right, and it's my favorite movie.
All right, a slow and strange movie. We will make sure to link to that on the show notes. What's your favorite? What's your favorite ice cream?
Oh, I like something super sweet, like pralines and cream, you know, or like Rocky Road. I like
that. All right, and last one, if we were to take a picture of you really happy and doing something you love, what would we see you doing?
I'd be in bed with my wife.
Ooh. Is this like the early holding each other, or were we getting a scandalous picture? I just want to make sure I can visualize it.
I don't know. It would start off early, and then it would get scandalous, and then it would end just cuddling up, you know? I mean, like sometime in there. You take a movie, and then you pick a frame. Any of those would probably be pretty happy.
That's wonderful. Well, Jonathan Penner, thank you for being here. Thank you for helping us believe in true love, honestly, and vulnerability, and what it means to make each other's dreams come true. Thank you for sharing your wife's legacy with us.
My pleasure.
For a lot of us who are married or partners, I don't think we always focus on the daily joy. We focus on the daily annoyances. You know, how he doesn't load the dishwasher right, or how she leaves her messes on the floor. But you are reminding us that every day is a gift, and to be loved and vulnerable.
It is a gift. If you have one more second, I can just speak to that.
Because, I do.
Okay, there are two things that come to my mind. One is, if you don't like the way they're doing it, then do it yourself. In other words, you either do it yourself and it gets done the way you want, or you let them do it, and though it's not done the way you want, you don't have to think about it anymore. Okay? It's yours. You want the responsibility? Do it. And then, yes, it's going to drive you crazy for a day when it's not the way you want to do it. And they say, oh, shit, I never have to think about the dishes again. That's his job. And fiddly, bing, bang, boom. Okay? You know, and the other is, nobody is perfect. No relationship is perfect. Certainly my relationship with Stacy wasn't perfect. We thought about murdering each other all the time. You know, I mean, honestly, we fought because because we never let each other get away with any bullshit. There was never any stuff between us that we needed to get through. If somebody said something offensive, you know, then you say, you can't say that. But let's clear the air right now. So that there is never any buildup, you know? And so you simply are engaged all the time. And when somebody says something mean, that's really what it is. If somebody says something unkind or thoughtless, you say, no, sorry, not going to let you say that to me. No one talks to me like that, and certainly not you. And let's not have that anymore. Because nobody's perfect. Nobody's going to handle everything perfectly. We all make mistakes. And you just got to have a couple of boundaries and say, no. My self-respect says you cannot speak to me like that. And they might go, it's all your fault. And she'd say to me, you're like a peeled peach. You're so tender and vulnerable all the time. And I'd say, yeah, I'm a peeled peach. And when you drop a peeled peach, it really hurts. So don't drop the peach. Treat the peach with the tenderness that the peach deserves. And then the peach is happy. And you've got a very nice little piece of fruit that you don't have to pick up and clean up after, you know.
Oh, Jonathan Penner, the peeled peach. I love this. To love and be loved. To trust someone, not just in strength, but in vulnerability. To hold someone's hand on their last day. Thank you for your storytelling. And to all of our listeners, we are wishing you love and light wherever the day takes you. Be good to yourselves. Be good to one another. And we will see you again soon on this wild and precious journey. Wild Precious Life is a production of Evergreen Podcasts. Special thanks to executive producers Gerardo Orlando and Michael D'Aloia, producer Sarah Wilgrube, and audio engineer Eric Coltnow. Be sure to subscribe and follow us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there!
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey. We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of
Sleepover Cinema, our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon!